The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 82. Dalung's hard and fast body of reality, the pointer. Only those with eyes can know the fishing line. Only adepts can handle devices outside of patterns. But say, what is the fishing line? What are devices beyond patterns? To test, I'm citing this old case. Look. A monastic asks Master Dalung, the physical body rots away. What is the hard and fast body of reality? Dalung said, the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The valley streams are brimming blue as indigo. Poem. Asking without knowing, answering, still not understanding. The moon is cold, the wind is high, on the ancient cliff, frigid juniper. How delightful, on the road he met a person who had attained the way, and didn't use speech or silence to reply. His hand grasps the white jade whip and smashes the black dragon's pearl. If he hadn't smashed it, he would have increased its flaws. The nation has a code of laws, 3,000 articles of offenses. Good morning, everyone. This morning we're completing this retreat with Vangeline. I was here teaching Bhutto, the crucible of body and mind. And I was thinking about that image of the crucible, where we bring together these different elements and bring them together and make something new. Dada Rushi also spoke about spiritual practice and Dharma practice as having a creative element where the mind leaps free of patterns and devices and brings forth something new. And that which is brought forth anew is actually not new at all. It's always been there. We call it Buddha nature. Self-nature, original nature, original face. But it's new for the student. It's realized directly. And the images of meeting someone for the first time and realizing all along you've known them, all along they've been there. We can speak of this path as a path of peace, doing no harm, cultivating all the virtues that went into each other's lives. But true peace is not a result of any action. Liberation is not something anyone has ever created. When there's a fight going on or a war going on, efforts do need to be made to stop fighting. But that doesn't mean that we've attained peace. The efforts of practice, the joyful effort of the paramita, of effort, is the practice of allowing ourselves to actually rest, to return to that great peace, which is always there, and to stop actively creating the misfortune and the pain and the divisiveness and confusion and bewilderment. And because that's been going on such a long time and is such a deep pattern, a habit, it's left alone, it will continue. And so we have to apply a lot of effort just to bring that into cessation, to allow that to rest. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti speaks about a bodhisattva who is ill, and the illness here is of delusion, of the pain and suffering that we create. And he says, a bodhisattva who is ill should train their mind by realizing that that illness arises due to the effects of their past actions, karma, resulting from misperceiving things that are not true, not the way they seem. It has arisen due to the defilements, greed, anger, and delusion, false views, attachments, resulting from imagining things that are not utterly real, that don't exist in any absolute state. From the view of ultimate truth, one cannot apprehend any real thing here which has this illness, which inherently is deluded. Why? This body consists of the four elements, and these elements have no master, nor anyone who sets them into motion, because this body is without any intrinsic self. This so-called illness can only be apprehended as a result of our obsession with the self. Let us then remain unobsessed with the self and fully cognizant, fully aware of the roots of our illness. May all beings be free of suffering and know the root of their suffering. May all beings know happiness and the root of their happiness. Someone asked Vimalakirti, what is the liberation from this illness? And Vimalakirti said, it is the liberation of egoism and possessiveness, of our attachment to the self and others and things. And so, in the pointer talks about adepts handling devices outside of patterns is a poetic way of saying of being able to experience things as they are. Right? That when we see something or someone, that in the first moment, Buddhism says there's a pure contact, untainted, clean, clear. But in the very next instant, before we can, that is immeasurable. Well, actually, the Buddhism measures it as 1/64th of that. So you can work out the. But that in that instant, that image is flooded with our egoism and possessiveness, with our experiences, our associations, our knowledge, our beliefs, and so on. And so to experience things as they are, not within the constraints and the definitions of that clinging mind, which is anxious, not in terms of what the Buddha spoke of as me or mine. And so in this koan, a student brings this question to Master Dalung, about whom there's very little known. In fact, this koan is about all that has survived of this master, even at what time he lived. He's a Chinese master. And so the student says, the physical body rots away. What is the hard and fast body of reality? And so the basic understanding of Buddhism, of reality, is that everything is impermanent. Nothing is fixed. Nothing exists by itself, independently, because that would mean that it's not subject to change. It's not subject to outside influences because it exists independently. The fact that everything is subject to change means that everything is influenced by everything, therefore that it doesn't exist independently or autonomously. And so the physical body rots away, right? It is born, it grows up, right? Gets strong, and then it starts to that long path of descent, right? That the Buddha realized is inescapable. Everyone gets older, everyone gets sick, everyone dies. So what are we to do? And so in Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism speaks about the different bodies of the Buddha. Now, the ordinary world, our ordinary lives, we're all kinds of bodies. There are black bodies and brown bodies and white bodies. There are male and female, and neither male nor female bodies. There are old and young bodies, bodies coming into being, bodies fading away from this life. The three bodies of the Buddha, one scholar I was reading said, arose in response to the sense of taking refuge. So we take refuge in the Buddha. Well, what does that mean? When we take refuge in the Buddha, are we taking refuge in the physical body of the Buddha, in the human person that the Buddha was, Shakyamuni? Because that body is subject to decay, right? It died a long time ago. And so in a sense, it's not suitable. How do you take refuge in a physical body that has rotted away? And so the three bodies of the Buddha are the Dharmakaya, which is the body of reality. So we see ourselves as this body of characteristics and qualities. It's how we recognize each other, what we look like, our personalities, our histories, the way we talk, all of it. The Dharmakaya is the body that has no characteristics. It's the body that is revealed when the mind is no longer apart, when it is no longer bringing all of that karmic history and associations. It's the body that can only be seen free of your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, and mind. It can't be perceived because it has no characteristics, but it can be realized. It is an unconfined body, free, boundless. And it is the body that we each possess. We speak of it as the body of the Buddha. The Sambhogakaya is the body reward of bliss, of enjoyment. That is a body that is endowed with the skillful means that arises from practice, that arises from a mind that is clear, that is calm, a mind that is awakened to the nature of things. And the Nirmanakaya, kaya in each of these, it means body, and the Nirmanakaya is the manifestation body. So how does the Dharmakaya, endowed with all of these virtuous aspects of enlightenment, how does it show up? How do we see it? How do we experience it? And so that's the manifestation body. So the Buddha was a Nirmanakaya, was an example of the Nirmanakaya of Shakyamuni. I've thought of this in my own mind, this is my way of looking at it, is that this body of the Buddha, this enlightened being, just seemed too large, right? Too vast, too profound to be just described as or contained within just a physical body. How do we speak of it? It's kind of interesting, too, that in Christianity, there are the three aspects. And so the physical body rots away. What is the hard and fast body of reality? What is the Dharmakaya body? Everything is impermanent. Everything rots away. Everyone we know, every time and place, each one of us in this hall, let's say in 100 years, probably safe, will not be here. Every relationship, every belief, every creation, everything we've done, the fruits of our efforts, all of our dreams, at some point will no longer be in this world. Nothing exists beyond a state of change. And everything that we perceive is a result of karmic actions and internal and external conditions. They come together and they come apart. Shantideva said, all that I possess and use is like the fleeting vision of a dream. It fades into the realms of memory, and fading will be seen no more. It's gone. This moment, this day, this retreat will never come back again. Shantideva says, the thought came never to my mind that I too am a brief and passing thing. Right? It's okay that all of you are impermanent. It's not so okay that I'm impermanent. It never came to my mind. I've never really spent time reflecting on that. And so, because of my greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy, I've hurt people. I've done things that caused harm. All the while, never halting, night or day, my life is slipping by. Nothing that is past can be regained. And what but death will be my destiny? We know this, but we don't really know it. And so Buddhism encourages us to turn towards that thing that we don't want to face, our mortality. You know, think about when in your young, sweet, tender life did you first encounter death, the reality of death? A pet? For me, it was a friend, John Yancey, in high school, that I found out. I wasn't even really friends. We were just in the same class, but I found out he'd been killed in an accident. And I remember my mother and I were at the table. She was helping to teach me how to sew. We were sewing, working on a project. And there was a phone call, and she came and told me. And it was like, what is that? He was here. I saw him in school last week. And now he's dead. What is that? And then it comes closer. Inevitably, people who are closer to us, sometimes early, sometimes later in life. I worked in a funeral home in college, which worked very hard, really, to keep people at a distance from death, to keep it safe, which was, from my view, a great disservice. And so Buddhism says, come close. Come close when you get the chance. And before then, bring it close in your mind. So there are practices where we visualize ourselves aged, losing control, in our deathbed, dying, dead. Not because that's the same thing as when it's actually happening, but it helps to bridge that gap. It helps us to turn towards what we don't want to face and begin to take it into this body, to experience it and see what does the body, how does the body respond? What are the emotions? Can we even stay with that image? Or does it keep running away, running away, running away? The body is the great timekeeper, isn't it? Day by day, year by year, the body is like a living manifestation of impermanence. And for a long time, we can, well, if we're lucky, we're relatively healthy, we can kind of put it off, right? It's one of the things about youth is death is a, you know, our death is a distant kind of an idea. But then as we get older, it's like, oh, all right, letting go a little bit of this, losing a little bit of that, gravity wins. It's not so distant. It becomes easier to actually see, oh, this is where this is going. I can see it now. Right? I see it around me, but I can see it here. It's starting to be real. And so all along the question is how to be free and unhindered in this body, this karmic body, subject to aging, illness, and death. The physical body rots away. What is the hard and fast body of reality? The footnote to that says, his statement makes them into two. Physical body, body of reality. And it says, still, it's all right to separate them. It's okay to do that. We talk about many aspects of the body, of the person, our heart, our mind, our intellect, our thoughts, our emotions, our past and present, our delusion, our enlightenment, the virtues, compassion, loving kindness, generosity, patience. And so it's like all of these different aspects. And so we bring them into view, which separates them, creates a sense of two. But it's okay to do that, because then it allows us to focus on that aspect, maybe to cultivate it, maybe to bring it out. Maybe some of those aspects we don't really want. We've cultivated them. They're not actually helpful. And so we actually let those begin to drop away. The Dharmakaya is the unborn, undying nature of mind, of self. So what is it when the physical body rots away? What is the hard and fast body of reality? And Dalung says, the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The valley streams are brimming, blue as indigo. Well, that's surprising. The flowers are the very essence of impermanence. They don't last more than a few days. They're ephemeral, but they're fleeting. And the river, like this body, this person, is always moving. The old saying, you can't stand in the same river twice, but it's this river. The Buddha likened it to the candlelight on the altar. There's something that remains the same, but it's constantly changing. It's not the same, but it is, but it's not. How do we resolve that? And the commentary says, if you try and work this out with words, it's like trying to hit the moon by waving a stick. You won't make any connection. And so this koan is presented as a way for the student to take these words and not use them as words. In other words, to use them to bring one into intimate contact with this body of reality. And in order to do that, we have to go into this physical body and see that they are not two. The body of form, of emotion, of sensation, mental activity, of meaning, so that we can realize the body that is free of form and emotion. That's not who you are. Thoughts arise. But as Vimalakirti said, there is no master. They don't belong to someone. Can you find someone they belong to? Can you locate where they actually live? The closer we look, the more evasive they become. And so to realize that formless, unborn body, and in doing that, we realize that all aspects of the self that arise have the same nature. And then we continue in training to realize that body of a formless form, of non-abiding emotion, of empty of inherent meaning, so that we're not turning away from anything. We're not negating anything. Everything is here in abundance. But now we can work with it outside of the patterns. In other words, we're no longer caught within our habitual ways of being, our incomplete or false ways of seeing and understanding. And so in the poem, he says, "The moon is cold, the wind is high on the ancient cliff, frigid juniper." This image, these images of being cold, frigid, bathing in the moon's glow, are images of that Dharmakaya where there is not so many things. Right? In winter, what happens to all of the fecundity of life? It withers up, passes away. It's just a frozen landscape. Everything, all of that complexity and the highs and lows and colors and textures all become one within a layer of snow. There's no movement. There's no sound. There's an image to bring forth that body of reality. But then that gives way to spring. And all of that life arises from that which appeared to have no life. Why is that important? It's reasonable to ask. Why this emphasis on realizing this body of emptiness, this body without characteristics, when our life is filled with all of this goings on? Why does realizing the nature of the self liberate us from our attachments? Well, what we see is that all of these entanglements, these knots, as the Buddha spoke of them, arise from and create a home within this body, which is what we call the person. So if you think of yourself as a home, the place where you live, your location, your address. My address is Shugen, right? Everywhere I go, there it is. How can you locate it? Well, just look for this. And when this personhood is realized to be empty, a person, of being, of a life, of a soul, then where would all of the afflictions that arise from this home arise from? Right? I mean, the thing is, when you have a house, you got to take care of it, right? You got to have locks on your doors. You might want to build a gate. If you see somebody intruding, you got to go check it out. Are they friendly? Are they not friendly? You got to pay insurance. It might burn down. It takes a lot of work to maintain that home. And having it, particularly if you really love that home, that can create a lot of anxiety. What if you lose it? Right? What if you can't afford the mortgage? Right? But you need some place to live. And it's nice to take care of it, right? Because then it'll take care of you. So we call that caretaking, in fact. So the home is not the issue here. The fact that we have this body and mind, the fact that we get older, that we fall ill, that we die, is not the problem in Buddhism. When we focus on those things as the problem, then we try and mitigate or avoid or control those very things. So can I live forever? Can somebody crack that code? Can I never get sick? Can I not age? But when we realize that that home is just a home. You can build a gate, but the gate doesn't know keeping in or keeping out. It's just wood. We can put a lock on the door, but the lock doesn't know I am keeping everyone safe. It doesn't even think I am a lock. Vimalakirti said, there is no master. There is no person driving the thing. That's what Buddhism calls our delusion. And yet the wonder of this body and mind, this consciousness, is that in each moment it arises in clear awareness and responds and that in that moment, and then it passes, never to return. And then another moment arises. That in order to do that, in order to live, we don't have to have a personhood, a person, a being that exists by itself. It's like clouds. Clouds appear in the sky. In one moment, they cool a hot sun. That shade feels so good. They bring life-giving rain. In the next moment, they appear and they block the sun's radiance. Everything gets cold. They bring terrible floods and storms. But the clouds, no matter how they appear, can't be grasped. You can't contain them. You can't possess them. The cloud doesn't think, I am shading you. I am making you cool in a pleasant way. I am making you cold in an unpleasant way. They don't have that thought. They don't need that thought. And so to come to terms with these bodies of the Buddha, you know, Buddhism recognizes we can only know, like what we're trying to do is know how as human beings to live in this world. We're not trying to figure out how is it, can a dog live in harmony in this world? How a mosquito can live in this world without creating suffering. We're not trying to solve those problems, right? So that's a load you can take off your plate, right? Because we've got plenty already. We're just focusing on the human project. And what we find is that as we begin to understand and bring that into illumination, the whole world actually changes. Because we realize it's not just a human project. We are not just people. We are not separate and independent. But we can only know our experience through this body, these instruments, these senses. You know, I was reading an article about the way different creatures experience the world, and they were talking about, I guess, a certain species of bat. And it was talking about how bats scream, right? And they send out this scream, and it echoes. I forget the term for it, but it echoes off of solid objects and bounces back so that the bat can, like radar, locate, right? Like an insect that is flying that they want to eat. But when they scream, it's so loud that it would make them go deaf. So when they scream, their ears close. But then they have to open their ears to listen to the bounce back, which happens very fast. And so they have muscles in their ears that open and close 200 times a second. Like, they say they're the strongest or fastest moving muscles in any living thing. I mean, that is quite a symphony, right? That is quite an arrangement. So what is their world like? When you're walking your dog, or when I'm watching my cat sit at the window, like, what are they smelling? Why is that important? Because when we project that our world is the world, just among the human realm, that something is true for me, that when I experience something, that is your experience. There's enough that's in common that when you feel pain, I have some sense of what that feels like. When I see that you're happy, I have a pretty good sense of what that feels like. And Buddhism says, use that Use that commonality to generate compassion, to not cause somebody else pain, to want them to be happy. But it's not just a matter of granting that each other have different experiences. You're okay, and I'm okay. Because that can just come down to a world of relativity. What's okay for you is okay for you. What's okay for me is okay for me. But what about when those conflict? When what is okay for you is causing me harm? That's not okay. So Buddhism is not relativistic, that there are fundamental things in the human realm that are good and that are not good. How do you know? Because one affirms life and one destroys it. One creates suffering and one alleviates it. Sometimes that's clear, sometimes it's not. So we, in practice, learn and study what we call morality, causing pain and alleviating pain, to be able to see the differences. But it's not just enough to grant that for each other. That's like a measured peace, a measured truce. Let's agree to not disagree until we disagree again. Let's agree not to fight until we end up fighting again. It's tenuous. It's good, right? Let's do more of that, but it's tenuous. It is always subject to change. That's why the Buddha was looking for a liberation that is not subject to change. That's why realizing this hard and fast body of reality is liberating. When we realize that all things have no inherent existence, including beliefs and views, and there are beliefs and views that are affirming of life, and there are others that are not affirming of life. We see that everywhere. But when we see that they're actually empty of any absolute truth, and the idea of fighting and hating and killing over an idea, over a belief, doesn't make sense. That fundamental body of reality, because it is empty, cannot be corrupted or distorted. You can't buy it. You can't patent it. You can't manipulate it. That only happens in the mind. Master Dogen said the way of seeing mountains and rivers differs according to the type of being that sees them. A hungry ghost sees water as raging flames, as pus and blood. Dragons and fish see it as a palace or a tower. All of these different beings see mountains and rivers differently. I mean, just think of all the living things and how they're experiencing their world. And we see them in their world through our world. So Dogen says, thus what different types of beings see is different, and we should reflect on this fact. Is it there are various ways of seeing one thing? Or is it that we have mistaken various images of one object for one object? We should concentrate every effort on understanding this and then concentrate still more. Given this multitude of perspectives, it follows that training on the practice, on the way of practice and verification, in other words, practicing the Dharma, must not be merely of one or two kinds, but of 1,000 types and 10,000 kinds. In other words, practice, formal training is teaching us how, within our miraculous awareness, to see and begin to examine all one object from many different perspectives, one world with all of its different aspects. What is the hard and fast body of reality? The mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The valley streams are brimming blue as indigo. You, yourself, coming and going in each moment, alive today, at some point, passing away. And all is working together, this body and mind, whatever state it's in, whether we are healthy or sick, whether we're young or old, is not in conflict with itself. It is not in conflict with the world. The Buddha said, I do not argue with the world. The world may argue with me, but I do not argue with the world. I am not in conflict with the world. That's our nature. That is the hard and fast body of reality. When we see that, when we let go, what are we doing when we let go of a thought, of an emotion, of a belief, of a memory? We're really letting go of all of the different bases upon which we become in conflict with the world. We're always in conflict over something. When we see that all of those things have no intrinsic, absolute quality, nature, truth, that the very nature of truth is empty. It doesn't have any absolute. It can't be found somewhere. That's why to attach to worldly things or to attach to Buddhist things, it's all kind of regarded the same as becoming a point of conflict. So one way of looking at it is when we are in conflict with something, which means any kind of suffering, any kind of dis-ease, what are we attaching to? What are we creating some absolute sense of? And that's a helpful way of bringing us into the thing that we can focus on, that we can bring our attention to, that we can examine. Which means when we see ourselves turning something that is alive and dynamic into something that is static and dead, to free, not that object, because the object is free, but to free our mind of turning it into something dead. So every moment that we're practicing, on or off the cushion, that we see something that we're grasping at and we let go, we're liberating. We're allowing that thing and this body and mind to be free of that conflict, of that tether. And so that's why it says, how wonderful to meet a person of the way who has attained the way, who doesn't resort to speech and silence, who doesn't fall into dualities. So if good or bad don't have any intrinsic value, then what is the point of compassion? Because there is suffering. Because there is doing harm and there is doing good. There is helping and there is hurting. The nation has a code of laws, 3,000 articles of offenses. We live in a world that has laws like karma, like gravity, like impermanence. And within that, there are a multitude of ways in which we can come into conflict, that we can falter, that we can make things difficult. And in the commentary, he says that what this really comes down to is respect, being respectful. And I think he's speaking from the deepest sense that when we understand that everything fundamentally is complete within itself, has its own completeness, has its own dignity because of that completeness. Not because of what it's done or what it's achieved or how it looks to us, but just because it is. Then that just naturally brings forth a sense of respect. You know, why do we make a point of handling things, whether it's a stick of incense or the shoes on the shoe rack or your robe or the dishes that we're cleaning, mindfully? That's just another way of saying, treat it with respect. You know, in our throwaway culture, it's like, well, you know, if I wear this out through neglect, I'll just buy some more. That is not a good way of being in relationship. And don't we see it? And so Vimalakirti says, let us remain unobsessed with this self and fully cognizant of the roots of our illness. I say amen to that. And the wonderful thing about practice is no matter where you are on the path, beginning, middle, wherever you are, and whatever you do in any moment, to any degree that brings you in accord with the Dharma, means you're bringing yourself into alignment with who you actually are. And that brings forth good. And so then we can relax a little about where am I? How much further? How much have I? When will I? Have I attained? Every single step, well placed, matters. So in closing, I'd like to thank Vangeline for coming and being so generous with yourself and your teachings and your artistry. We'll look forward to seeing you again. And all of you who were part of the retreat, particularly those of you who came, joined us for the weekend, who really brought your enthusiasm and desire to be here and work with Vangeline and practice. Thank you for that. So I'll end with a poem. Who can say why the wind blows, the flower blooms, the river runs? Arguments and opinions fill the sky, and yet never really satisfy the true hunger. So let us sit together and see without error the rising and falling of worlds and wonders, and bring forth the many hands and eyes of the one who forsakes no living thing.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.